Evening, everybody. Go ahead and flip to Psalm 39 if you'd like to follow along. I'll have it up on the screen in a second. When I first started teaching on the Psalms several months back, I had kind of built up like a little backlog of Psalms that I had gotten really interested in and built up information on, things I could talk about. And I've worked through those, and so now I'm getting to the point that I'm picking each month a Psalm that I haven't necessarily dove into before to preach on. And when I do that, there's this point of like, even though I know there's a lot in the text, it's like, is there really enough in this Psalm that I could talk about it for half an hour? Like, do I really, is it just very, very simple, or is there really enough there? And again, obviously this is God's word. There's a lot there. But what's interesting to me is the more and more I dig into the scriptures, the more and more there's just so much there. And so a psalm that's relatively short, I think 12 to 13 verses this evening, there's just so much there. And I continue to be impressed by that. So with that, let's go ahead and dive in. I'm going to start by reading the psalm in its entirety. A couple times we'll hear David, this is a psalm of David, describing man as a breath. That word is actually closer to a vapor. And it's the same word that gets translated as vanity or vanity of vanities in Ecclesiastes. So it's that same kind of tone that's coming in this psalm. Let's go ahead and read, starting in verse 1. I said, I will guard my ways, that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle, while the wicked are in my presence. I was mute and silent, I refrained even from good, and my sorrow grew worse. My heart was hot within me, while I was musing, the fire burned. And then I spoke with my tongue. Lord, make me to know my end. And what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. Behold, you've made my days as handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. And now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I've become mute. I do not open my mouth, because it is you who have done it. Remove your plague from me. Because of the opposition of your hand, I'm perishing. With reproofs, you chasten a man for iniquity. You consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath. Selah. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I'm a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. Turn your gaze away from me that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. One of the major things that really drew me to this psalm is a statement that comes at the end of each section before the Selah. So we see at the end of the first section, surely every man at his best is mere breath. And then you get to the end of the second section, and that's reduced slightly to say, surely every man is a mere breath. And then you get to the very end of the psalm, and it says, before I depart and am no more. And it's just very capturing, that language. It's very pensive. And the thoughts in here about thinking about how transient we are, I think, is something that impacts all of us and kind of catches our attention. And the structure of the psalm even is a little bit, kind of gives a nod to that topic. So this doesn't follow what I'm about to say explicitly, but a lot of times in ancient Israel poetry, if they had a dirge or a eulogy or something, they would do like 66 lines for the first section, then 44, then 22. And it would like trail off into, essentially the poetry would die off. And while this doesn't follow the same thing in terms of exact number of lines, you can see how that pattern is here, that you have a big section followed by another big section, and then it gets very small at the end and just ends with, before I am no more. And then the psalm just ends. This is also an interesting song to me because it doesn't end with what I would call a nice, happy resolution. A lot of psalms have a lot of struggle in the middle, but by the end of it, it says, like, rejoice and praise God, everything is taken care of. And this psalm doesn't end with that. I think that's something interesting and worth wrestling with. And the other thing I think is really interesting is the more that I've been studying the Psalms, and you start to look at not just the Psalm itself, chapter 39, but look at the Psalms around it. There's a lot of interesting parallels. So a lot of people have commented that this has a lot of commonality with Psalm 38. And if you read those together, that's helpful. I actually think all the way from 37 to 41, there's five Psalms there. And I think they're meant to be basically a little body of work. The book number one in the Psalms ends with chapter 41. And so this is the last five Psalms of that book. And if you read those collectively, I think they come together nicely. Just to kind of show you how some of this works and lead into Psalm 39, I want to look at 37 and 38 just briefly and some of the things that are kind of, I guess, planted in the ground so they can get teased out here in this psalm. So Psalm 37 starts with what I would call a very black and white picture of good and evil. Everything about evildoers is very negative, and everything about the righteous is very positive. So here I've just got a few of the comments towards evildoers from this chapter. So this is in verse 1 of Psalm 37. Be not envious towards wrongdoers, for they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. And you may already notice some of this language, how similar that is to what we read in Psalm 39. In verse 10, yet a little while and the wicked man will be no more. And you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. And then in verse 20, but the wicked will perish, and the enemies of the Lord will be like the glory of the pastures. They vanish like smoke. They vanish away. And so again, you may notice the commonality between where David, these are all Psalms of David, where David is describing himself in 39 in the way that it's actually describing the wicked in 37. So I think that's interesting. Looking at the Psalms that praise the doer of good or the righteous person, verse 3, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Verse 7, rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way. Verse 9, for evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. 37, mark the blameless man and behold the upright, for the man of peace will have a posterity. In verse 40, the Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him. So this chapter does have what I think is like that nice pretty picture at the end, right? It's very simple that if you follow God, he will take care of you. Things will be resolved. But there's a conflict because, like I said, everything that's being discussed in 39 doesn't really match that. What you get to in 38 is really interesting. This is a psalm where David seems to be working through a secret sin within his own life. So he starts off saying, rebuke me not in your wrath, chasten me not in your burning anger. So again, fire and flame and burning is something that comes up throughout these, and you can kind of trace them from in this case, it's God that is burning with anger, but in 39, we will see the way that David is starting to burn. For your arrows have sunk deep into me, and your hand has pressed down on me, another commonality you will see in 39. There's no soundness in my flesh because of your indignation. There is no health in my bones because of my sin. And I'm not going to go on to read the entire rest of these comments from Psalm 38. But if you just take time on your own and read the psalm in its entirety, it's very clear that it's centered around David and his sin and how that's affected his life and how he's so weak and trembling because of it. And you can even see there in 13, the comment here is very similar to 39. I'm mute, a mute man who does not open his mouth. When we get to Psalm 39, I think we're at the middle point of a five-chapter series, essentially. And it starts with a very clear, I don't want to call it naive, because obviously the scriptures aren't naive, but it's a very almost innocent view of good and evil. Those who are good, this is what's going to happen. Those who are evil, this is what's going to happen. Psalm 38 kind of complicates it. We're introduced to David and his sin, and all of a sudden he is now experiencing those things that are said of in 37 as what the wicked would feel. So even though David, throughout his whole life, is a good person, he's now put in the place of the evil man and having the trials and the frustrations of the evil man. And when I get to Psalm 39, I think that's where we see David just kind of in the middle of wrestling with it. It's not so much focused on directly on the sin itself, but it's him trying to work through it after the fact and wrestle with, why is life this way? Why is there suffering? Why am I feeling these things that I'm feeling? And so that's the, I think that's the tone that we're meant to have as we enter Psalm 39. So for the rest of the time, we're just going to step through point by point through the psalm. I've got here the very first phrases. So he starts here and he says, I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle while the wicked are in my presence. It's a funny thing to start it with, I said, because the next four lines are all about how he's not going to speak. But apparently what's going on here is he's made a point to guard his ways when he's around the wicked, and specifically with the things that he's saying. I don't know exactly why he's saying that. The sense that I get from this and the rest of the chapter, which we'll go through, is that possibly David's in a situation where God has had discipline on him, been hard on him, maybe taken some things away in David's life. David may be frustrated. And if he just opens his mouth around the wicked, A, that could be bad for him. They could make use of it. But B, that's bad for God because he could be blaspheming God to others. So he seems to be very stern here that he's going to be very cautious and guard his mouth and not speak. But then in the second section here, we see that the silence and the effect of it kind of grows. So he says, I was mute and I was silent. And then there's this kind of curious phrase, I refrained even from good. It's kind of hard just to look at this phrase and know what that means. The word for refrain is also often translated as held my peace. So I held my peace even from good. And I think the point here is, yes, it's important to make sure that you're not saying bad things, especially around those who are evil. But if you take that so far that you're never even going to do anything good, maybe you've gone too far. And then he says, and my sorrow grew worse. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. And then he'll say, then I spoke with my tongue. And we're going to see this transition where David is still being silent towards others, but he's finally going to open his mouth towards God. But we get this sense of turbulence within David. He says, my heart was hot within me, and while I was musing, the fire burned. Musing there, the Hebrew is not directly related to musing like music and poetry. It's more just meditation, thoughtful meditation. But as David sits on his own and is meditating and thinking and processing life and trying to hold it all in, pressure is building up. And I think that's maybe a clear lesson for us, obviously, that if we're constantly bottling everything in, maybe it's okay that we're not expressing that to others around us. Sometimes that's really important to do. Sometimes maybe it's not the right situation. But if you're bottling things in so much that you won't even open up to God, does that pain go away? No, it bottles up and it builds. And so then in this third section, we see where David finally starts to speak. And he says these words, Lord, make me to know my end. And what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. First thing that comes to mind to me, just looking at these three lines, have you ever prayed for discipline? Sometimes I get this sense that like I need more discipline in my life from God. And so there I am and I'm about to pray for discipline. And it's like praying for patience. Like there's not too many ways to get discipline. And so it's like, I kind of have to pray like, God, give me discipline, but give me the strength to like stay under your discipline. Because it's really about whether I'm ready for that. Am I really ready to ask God for that? Am I really ready to sit through that, whatever that entails? And when you talk about the transience of life, when you talk about life being a vapor, I mean, what kind of situations in life make that apparent to you? So praying that to God, I feel like it's very like, That's a big step. That's not something to be taken lightly. And then the last three lines there, I think they're a nice mirror to those first three lines where he's essentially answering his questions to God. So he says, Lord, make me to know my end. And then the answer there is the first line there, behold, you have made my days as handbreadths. What is the extent of my days? And then he says, and my lifetime is nothing in your sight. And let me know how transient I am. And he says, surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Handbreadths, so this is not spans, this is handbreadths, this is this. And this is, I think, one of the shortest measurements you could use in ancient times. So if we talk in English about it, it was a game of inches. That's kind of, I think, the type of language that David is using here is surely like, you can't measure my life in big, long strides. You measure my life in inches. It's just, it's over like that. And he concludes before the Selah, before the breaking point here, with the comment, surely every man at his best is a mere breath or a mere vapor or just smoke, just puffs into the air and then it's gone. And once again, as we commented, as this line kind of gets paired off and shortened as the psalm dies out. But here it's every man at his best or every man standing, taking a stand is still just nothing. And then we move into this second section here, this kind of middle third of the psalm. And I want to highlight the first and last parts of it. So again, thinking back to how that last line ended, that every man at his best or every man taking a stand is just a vapor. The first line of this one starts with, surely every man walks about as a phantom. The word for phantom there in Hebrew is tselem, which is the same word for image. So that's the same word when it says we're made in the image of God. That's also the same word for idol. So something like a statue, a shadow, an image, an icon, all those things are kind of conveyed by this. Phantom is the word that's used. I think that word gives a bit more of a nod to the end of, like if every man is just a breath, right? We're kind of just like ghostly. We're just passing away. But there's other ways that I think this line could be looked at. So if you think about this as every man walks about as an image, as something like purported, bigger, more lofty than it really is, something that's full of fluff. I think that's another interesting way to look at this line, because as we look at the rest in context, so surely they make an uproar for nothing, or a tumult, or a turbulence for nothing. And it says, he amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. And this line, to me, it reminds me of an Ecclesiastes. Solomon talks about you build up all this wealth, but then when you die, who's going to take it? A, you don't know, and B, it's going to go to somebody who didn't work as hard for it. So there's kind of that vanity in all those riches. Or maybe you think of the man who built bigger barns, and he spent all his life accumulating things, and then God said, sorry, this very day, your life is going to be taken from you. But we get this image that there's a type of person who's just amassing things, building up wealth, building up things, not knowing who's going to gather them. And you could look down towards the bottom where he says, at the last three lines there, with reproofs you chasten a man for iniquity, you consume as a moth what is precious to him. This whole section is very interesting to me. There's only a couple places in the scriptures that the term moth comes up, and one of them I think is pretty commonplace for us to remember. Jesus says, do not lay up your treasures where moth and rust destroy. He says, lay up your treasures in heaven, and that's where your heart is going to be. It's interesting. I almost get the sense within this psalm that David's life situation is that God has maybe taken away something from him. I don't know how it maps exactly to David's story, to situations we already see reading through 1 Samuel or whatever. But the type of issues that David seems to be floating up and expressing, it's almost as if he's in a situation kind of like Naomi, where Naomi's feeling bitter because she's left and gone off to Moab, and then her family's died, and when she comes back, she's like, God's made me bitter. God's done this to me. It seems like David's kind of nodding to things like that. But what's interesting is, as I kind of wrestled with this, I'm like, why is it talking about all this stuff, like essentially materialism, having all these things, and these things are going to be consumed anyway, they're not worth anything. Why is that put right next to every man is a mere breath? Every man is a vapor. Everything is just going to be like that, and life is over. Why are those together? And what's interesting is I think there's actually a thread throughout the scriptures that these two things are actually very intertwined. So you can look in the book of James chapter 4 if you would like. I don't have it on the screen, but that's where he says, don't boast and say, here, we're going to go tomorrow over here and we're going to do this and this and we're going to go make a profit. And then he says, shame on you. You don't even know what tomorrow will be like. Your life is but a vapor. And so James is connecting this idea that when we're making plans like, well, I just know I'm going to live for a long time. I just know all this stuff, that we start to then simultaneously latch our heart to profit, to materials, to things, and build those things up in our lives. James, I think, is echoing even a little bit what Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount. And what's interesting, this word moth in Hebrew, I haven't researched it too deeply, but it looks like it's also the same word that's used for grass. And I think there may be a little bit of a wordplay going on there. You may have noticed grass came up in Psalm chapter 37. But when Jesus talks about where moth and rust destroy, he then moves to what looks like his next topic that's actually, I think, the same topic. And he says, do not worry, for which of you by worrying can add an hour to his life? And he goes on to give a situation of the lilies in the field right there with the grass, that God sustains them. And so I think that God is building for us this message that those things are tied. That if you're starting to care too much about the material things, you might be getting a little bit too secure just in how your life is going. And once again, David's prayer is a hard prayer to pray for. If we're going to go and pray, God, teach me how transient I am, there's only a couple ways to learn that message. Then in the center of this section, and now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. That first sentence, I think that's interesting. On the one hand, we could maybe read it as, and now, Lord, on what do I rely? My hope is in you. In other words, there's nothing else I'm waiting on but you. But the term wait is also interesting because I think that brings in that time element. So maybe he's saying, why would I wait upon anything else besides you? Or maybe he's saying, why would I even wait? What is waiting? There's if life is but a vapor, what is waiting? It seems like maybe there's a little bit of that duality in there. He says, deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I have become mute. I do not open my mouth because it is you who have done it. It's interesting here. David seems to have a very clear and strong vision that God is the reason for a lot of what's going on in his life. And a lot of the frustration in his life. This came up in, I think it was Psalm 77, where there's a very similar phrasing. And I don't feel like we ever talk about that. I don't feel like we say, yeah, my life's really rough right now because God's doing it to me. I don't know if this is just today's culture or what it is, but I think when we think of intimacy and relationship, we think of it as a lack of conflict. So to be intimate with God means that everything's good right now. It means that there's really not any issues. I'm being a faithful Christian. Life is good. My family's good. So I'm intimate with God. I don't think that's what we see in the Psalms. If you think about any time you're going to have real intimacy, two people who aren't married who are getting married, there's going to be more discussion. There's going to be more problems. There's going to be more problem solving. There's conflict, but that's actually where intimacy comes. I think of it as like if you take two puzzle pieces and you're going to interlock them, that's exactly when the pieces are going to start rubbing together and you have to press them in until they're together. And there seems to just be this sense with David and with the Psalms that being intimate with God does not mean that you're never going to have problems. And it doesn't mean that your problems in life are just because you messed up somehow. And I think when we read that God's going to discipline us as sons, we kind of go, oh, yeah, so he'll discipline us. I got it. But we don't actually connect those dots. Like maybe something is really hard in your life and maybe God is actually doing that to you. And I think that's a very sobering thought. Move to the last section here. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears. For I am a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. Turn your gaze away from me that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. This is an interesting section, I think, once again, because it's tapering off. It's dying off. It's very brief. And I don't know if this is intentional within the poetry. I think it may be that it's almost like the psalm ends before you think it will. So if you're just tracking, you're like, oh, this section was 16 lines, this section was 16 lines, this section was six. No, it wasn't. It ended too soon. And I think there's a lesson about the brevity of life within that. But there's other interesting things here. One, even though in the middle of the psalm, David is talking about praying out to God and speaking finally, it seems like he's still in a life stage of saying, I'm just going to be silent. I'm just going to be quiet. And he's still bottling it up, because here's what he says now, is hear my prayer, O Lord, give ear to my cry. I want you to hear my cry as my prayer out to you. And don't be silent at, or don't hold your peace at, my tears. That silent part of crying that makes no sound. But God, I want you to hear my tears, is the essence that's going on here. And then we see, again, where I'm bringing up that intimacy. For I am a stranger with you, and a sojourner like all my fathers. This is the first section of the psalm and the last section of the psalm, and I put these together because I think it's an interesting contrast. So you can see the four-line section and the three-line in the beginning, and here we see a three-line and a four-line. I think they're kind of a mirror image of each other. So if you just, I guess I didn't get that highlighted. If you just look at the middle sections, you can see where he's going from being mute and silent, refraining from good, and his sorrow's growing worse and worse. And then the middle section towards the end is kind of bringing that to a conclusion, that David is asking God to hear his tears and hear his cries. But you can also see an interesting contrast here, that we see that David struggling with being around the wicked, and what does he do there? And the conclusion, the resolution where David is moved to is, God, I get that some of these things aren't perfect, and I get that I haven't been perfect, but God, I'm a sojourner with you. I'm a stranger with you. I am guarding myself away from the wicked, and I am moving myself and going on a journey with you. So please take away this affliction. This phrasing is interesting. One comes up from David actually says it in the scriptures another time in a narrative, and I believe it's in 1 Chronicles 29, 15. He's making a speech about the coming temple, and he says almost this identical phrasing and then talks about being a vapor. So that's interesting. Abraham also used this phrasing, and I think it's pointed to notice here that he says, like all my fathers. David is sitting here wrestling, feeling alone, feeling like he can't talk to anybody, feeling this mixture of, I know my sin has put me in a bad place, but I feel like I've already moved on from that, yet I'm still not in a better place. Why am I still stuck? And he says, I'm a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. If you feel that way, Abraham felt that way too. How long did Abraham have to wrestle with when he would finally have a kid? How long did he have to take this thing that God told him, yeah, I'm going to give you the promised land, I'm going to do all these great things, and it's like, yeah, but it's been years, and I'm still stuck in the middle, feeling like I don't have a resolution to my problems. I think that's the place that David is at, is he's looking at this, and you can kind of come to peace without being fully at peace, because even though you're feeling alone in the moment, you're really not alone. Earlier back in Psalm 37, it said the righteous should not fear when they watch the wicked prosper. And I think there's something to be said there when we talk about that intimacy and conflict. There's a lot of people who do a lot of things, and they don't have this level of conflict. They just get by easily. They make the money, they have the home, they have the job, they have the kids, they have all this stuff, and it seems like life is very simple for them. And the, I guess, backhanded beauty of being conflicted is that it means God is trying to work on you. There are other people who aren't awake and aren't paying attention and aren't trying to serve God and aren't trying to build a relationship with them. And it seems like in those cases, God just kind of lets them coast when that's the right decision. But as David sits here conflicted, as you sit conflicted, it's a message that God is with you. You are a sojourner with him. And he's trying to work you through to something. And then we see these very last statement from David. Turn your gaze away from me that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. And I think what's going on here is I don't think David is really asking God, hey, God, you need to go away from me. I think it's the gaze, that gaze like of discipline, that look of discipline. God, please remove that from me. It's affecting me so much. And at the conclusion here, he really does learn what he had prayed to God for. He really does recognize the brevity of life. Before I depart and am no more. But I think the most impactful part of this psalm to me is that it ends without the real resolution. This psalm does not give us the answer to everything in David's life. This psalm does not end with, my life is solved. I have this thing worked out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It just doesn't. The psalm stops. And that's what we're left with. If you want to cheat, you can look ahead at Psalm 40, which I think is its own commentary on this section, and it gets a lot better. But I think we're meant to study this psalm and sit with it in its own as well, and to learn to accept the fact that things aren't always going to be solved right away, and sometimes we're going to have to sit with it for a while. And that's the message I have for tonight. We're going to have the closing song. If you need to come forward with any help, or if you're not a Christian yet and would like to become one, you can come forward while we stand and sing. Abide with me.